Hi, I'm Nick Rigoretti's, and this is the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast, the show for grapplers and martial artists that want to evolve both on and off the mat. Okay, guys, episode 10 of the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast. This is Matt Thornton. Now, so cool for me to be able to speak to Matt Thornton because he is a fantastic coach. He really is a coach's coach. He's got a deep insight into the science of jiu-jitsu. He's built a very powerful organization. He is indirectly the coach of Conor McGregor because he is the coach of Conor's coach, John Kavanagh. So there's clearly a stream of good jiu-jitsu and good martial arts that's running through this guy. And I just was so happy to be able to speak to him. So without further ado, here is episode 10, Matt Thornton. Hey guys, welcome back to the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast. This is episode 10, and I'm here with Matt Thornton. Now, the cool thing about this show for me is, and you guys may or may not know, I started training in submission grappling almost 20 years ago. And when I did, it was in South Africa with a gentleman named Ludwig Strydom. And the cool thing is, Ludwig had just come from a Matt Thornton seminar when I met him. He was still very much formulating the basis of his understanding of grappling and fighting, and Matt really informed it quite a lot. So I arrived to do my first couple of classes, and he was talking to us, the students, about the seminar he had just come back from and some of the concepts that Matt had taught him. And those really informed my game. And now, almost 20 years later, it's quite cool for me to come full circle and be speaking to Matt on the podcast. So, Matt, thank you so much for agreeing to chat to me on the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
That's great. Matt, would you just tell the listeners your background, not only how you came to become a martial arts instructor, but also your general background as well, please?
Sure. I've been fascinated by martial arts, in love with martial arts as I can remember since I was a kid. When I left the military, I had decided I was going to pursue boxing because I was looking for a martial art that I thought would be practical. I wanted to learn what worked in fighting and what didn't work in fighting. It was kind of my question that I obsessed over. I also found myself interested in Jeet Kune Do concepts. This was before the UFC, of course, and jiu-jitsu really hit the United States. And I liked Bruce Lee's idea of fighting at all ranges. I had been in a few street fights where I had been on the receiving end of some wrestlers, and I knew, you know, whether you had boxing or not, once they take you down, there's a huge gap in the game if you don't have some grappling. So I was attracted to that philosophy. I found some Jeet Kune Do instructors right after I left the Army. I worked with them for a couple of years. I moved up to Portland. I started teaching Jeet Kune Do concepts and Muay Thai kickboxing, as well as boxing at the boxing gym here. And I had a chance run in with a gentleman named Fabio Santos, who was one of Hickson's early black belts who had moved up to Portland, and he was building boats. And in order to get in shape, he put an advertisement in the newspaper asking for people to come try and beat him up. And if you could beat him up, he'd give you $50. And my partner and I, my friend from the boxing gym, we were paying to get beat up at the boxing gym. So we figured we might as well go try and make some money. And of course, I became friends, and the results were predictable. Fabio would take me down and finish with a choke or submission. And I fell in love with the art. And it wasn't shortly after that I ran across Hickson Gracie. I was blown away by what he was doing. And over time, I moved away from Jeet Kune Do concepts, and I realized I had kind of a difference of philosophy and a different way of approaching martial arts that wasn't congruent with what they were doing, and I needed to open up my own school. I did that. I think that was about 1992, 93, and that was the first SBG, and we've been going strong since. It's been about 25 years.
Wow, that's a pretty cool story. And how many academies do you have around the world affiliated to SBG at the moment?
Well, we have quite a few full-time big academies like John Kavanagh's in Ireland and others around the world, mine and my the vice presidents in Montana. And then we have a lot of affiliated groups that are in smaller towns where we have training groups. If you add them all up, I think we're getting close to 100 right now with probably 25 full-time big schools.
Well, I mean, that's pretty impressive. That would make you one of the biggest jiu-jitsu academy networks in the world.
Yeah, it's possible. I haven't actually looked at that, but you know, most of our growth these days comes organically from our own students. So, you know, I have 15 of my own black belts, and many of them want to go on and open up their own schools. And now my black belts have black belts, and we're getting into the third generation of black belts, and that the art kind of just grows that way. So it's happened very naturally.
Now, is this something that's beyond your wildest dreams, or was this always the plan? Did you always want to have this big network of schools, and or has it just grown, like, as you said, organically, and you've just gone along for the ride?
Yeah, I never had a plan. I did have a vision, I would say. I mean, when I first moved to Portland, Oregon, I had an idea of what I wanted to do as far as training. And what I had in my mind was more or less what MMA, what later became MMA. I had in my mind that I wanted to fight at all ranges and put equipment on and get students who would do that with me and figure out what works in fighting. And that was about as far as my plan went. And that's what initially drew me to Jeet Kune Do concepts. It's also initially what pushed me away from it into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and you know, more of a MMA curriculum. And when I first branched off, I didn't think I'd be able to even make any money, because most of the other guys around me, my peers in the JKD world, were confident in a very cynical sense that people want to collect certificates, people want to put a lot of notes in their notebook, they want to click sticks together, but man, nobody really wants to roll around and get tapped out. Nobody really wants to put headgear on and get hit. Nobody really wants to sweat. You're never going to be able to make any money that way. And I assumed that that was true, but that was the only way I could train. I didn't feel like I could ever teach somebody something I didn't think was, that I thought was bullshit. So I just assumed I'd always have a second job. I was actually very surprised as my gym started to grow, and I realized, wow, there's a whole bunch of people that want to train just like I do.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to hear that, because I've never met you, Matt. This is our first real interaction, but you do have quite a strong following, especially in regards to your perspectives on jiu-jitsu. And I'll never forget, I have a friend in South Africa who did traditional jiu-jitsu for a long time, and he also attended one of your seminars back in South Africa almost 20 years ago. And he related this story to me, that he went up to you at one point after the seminar and said, how do I change from traditional jiu-jitsu to Brazilian jiu-jitsu? He was basically asking for like the patch to upgrade. And you just said to him, it wasn't the answer he was looking for. You just said, you've just got to turn your back on everything and do a full 180. It's not something you can just like cross over into. You just have to start from the beginning. And I always, that to me is quite a profound story. It really left an impression on me. And I think it ties into you. I'm not sure if you were the person who came up with it, but in my mind, you're definitely the person who popularized the idea of aliveness when it came to martial arts training. Could you just share with us a little bit more about what that means to you?
Yeah, as that was something that came as a result of my training in the Jeet Kune Do concepts world and slowly leaving, you know, that community, and in the process explaining to people why things work and why things don't work. I mean, one of the most common questions people would ask, especially back then, this is really the question that started the UFC, was style versus style, right? Or, you know, is this style going to be able to beat that style? Does this style work? Does this style not work? That was Horian Gracie's great genius in marketing, is that, you know, the first few UFCs were Gracie Jiu-Jitsu versus, you know, other arts. And that was a very big question back before MMA existed. And it was something that I was also interested in. I've been interested in that question since I was a kid. And people would constantly ask that question. And ultimately, I realized that what distinguishes things that work and don't work isn't what culture they come from. It isn't necessarily even the specific techniques that exist, but it's how they train. So you're going to have wrestlers that train in an alive manner, and judo people who are going to train in a live manner, Muay Thai boxers train in a live manner, because they're athletes and they're training in a combat sport and results matter. And anytime results matter, then you switch to a meritocratic method. You switch to a form of competition. And the traditional martial arts had moved away from competition, and they were no longer training alive. They were training in sclerotic, you know, dead patterns that they would simply repeat. And then when you ask them why those techniques didn't arise, certainly not in the way they looked when they did their forms in actual sparring, assuming they even did sparring, they would always have a litany of excuses. Oh, it's too deadly. You will eventually get there. It was always nonsense. But rather than explain everything art by art, I thought, you know, there's really one word that sums it up. It's aliveness, and aliveness is timing, energy, motion. And if you take one of those elements out, it's not going to be alive. You see something ridiculous. One of the ridiculous trends these days, just to use an example, would be Sistema. And they will have a kind of an unpatterned motion. So they're not necessarily doing choreographed forms the way Aikido or Wing Chun or these other arts would. Mm-hmm. But there's no realistic energy. They're not dealing against the type of attack that someone would actually offer. You know, you have some guy that's pretending to grab them and then falling over while they make some matrix-like movement, stumbling over himself like a deer in a headlight. And if you just had an actual wrestler who had enough dignity not to play along with his game, of course, he would just be taken down to the ground. So they may have unchoreographed motion, but they don't have the actual proper energy. So you need all of it. You need the timing, you need the energy, and you need the motion. Timing meaning that it's not in a predictable pattern or rhythm. And unless something has all three of those things, it's not alive. And if you train something with aliveness, then, and you let the form the follow what works, so you will eventually wind up with a delivery system that's functional, which is what happened with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. It's what happens with boxing. It's what happens with all combat sports. And so to me, that was the really important thing to explain. And it's about the epistemology. This gets us back into philosophy, but it's very much like a difference between religion and science. Science is a very vigorous form of competition where you have to put forward your results to other people who are qualified to review them. I mean, I'm not qualified to review results about a black hole by any means. So somebody has equations related to a black hole, they have to bring them up to peers who are qualified to review them. But then they go through a real rigorous testing to the degree that the thing can be tested, and people try and tear it down and disprove your hypothesis. And only ideas that survive that competition come to be known as facts. And even those facts are subject to change in light of new evidence. And that's very different from a revelation from a grandmaster who's somehow come down from the mountains with these movements, which you have to repeat in the exact same way and which never change. Mm-hmm. And so traditional martial arts in that sense are very much like religion, and combat sports are very much a science. And the distinction between the two is the lack of aliveness or a form of competition.
Well, yeah, I really appreciate the way you break that down, and the way the main difference is the science religion analogy is fantastic. I mean, this is something that's I don't want to say close to my heart, but it's something I think about a lot, and that is why the traditional dead systems still continue to exist and still have relatively high levels of popularity. Where, I mean, look, we know the answer to does Wing Chun Kung Fu work in an alive situation. We know the answer. We know the answer is no. It's been proven. It's like if you put a Wing Chun guy in a UFC cage, he has no chance. He gets submitted by a jiu-jitsu guy or thrown by a wrestler or kicked the shit out of by a Muay Thai guy or has his head punched in by a boxer. It's just we know what happens. But it seems to be this stubborn streak whereby people will still go and pay the super overweight grandmaster with a ninth degree to teach them the demuck. And I'm just interested to know, what is it in the human psyche that causes that? I've heard a theory that it's this deep desire for us to have this ability to defeat the big bad guy using a magical system, like the big strong thug. You can overcome him using this like magic secret trick. Because in real life, or what's been my experience in jiu-jitsu, and it's something that I'm speaking about a lot, which is that size and strength actually do matter, and technique only helps up to a point. So all other things being equal, the bigger, stronger guy will win. And to tie it back, I think that that's what, even in jiu-jitsu, it still exists. People want to believe that they're these secret techniques that allow them to beat anyone. So I'm rambling a little bit, but it's, did you get what I'm asking, Matt? Why do you think this streak exists in martial arts and the human psyche in general?
Right. Well, I think, you know, you've hit the nail on the head as far as a lot of it. A lot of it is simply wish thinking. But one thing, anytime that question comes up, and it's a very common question, is I like to bring people back and remind them that just because something's been around for a long time or something's good at replication doesn't mean it's good for us. You know, the cold has been around for a long time. It's replicated itself really well. It's not necessarily good for us. So, you know, astrology has been around a long time. Astrology has been around for thousands of years. That doesn't mean it works. It doesn't mean it's anything other than bullshit. So things replicate themselves because they're good at replication. That's true biologically, and that's true in terms of culture, culturally. And traditional martial arts replicate themselves for many of the same reasons that religion replicates itself. It provides people answers that they want to have. And if someone is more motivated to validate their own wish thinking, if they want to believe something more than they want to know the truth about that something, then you can't help them. Nothing I say or anybody else says is going to get across to them at that moment, because they're not motivated actually by the truth. As soon as they become motivated to know the truth, then you can use evidence to persuade them, of course. But if they're not motivated to know the truth, if they're just motivated in pursuing their wish, it's not a lot you can do to help them, whether it's astrology or homeopathy or, you know, belief in witchcraft or ghosts or zombies or Aikido or Wing Chun. I mean, it's all the same.
Interesting. So it sounds, from what I can glean from your answers, that you would consider yourself a scientific materialist?
Yes and no. I mean, here's what I think the bottom line is as it relates to those types of things. I don't think it's healthy to ever pretend to know things we don't know. So if you were to ask me what happens after we die, I'm going to tell you, I don't know. If you ask me what I think happens after we die, I'm going to say, I think that when the brain is destroyed and, you know, consciousness is gone, because I think that it goes the same place it goes when people have Alzheimer's and all of a sudden they have memories and there's a person there that has a name that's loved and been human. And as time goes by and those memories are lost, and pretty soon that person, where is that person now? You know, because the brain, you know, consciousness in that sense is a word for what the brain does, in the same way that, you know, exercise would be a word for what the body does. But that doesn't mean I'm 100% positive I'm right. And if all of a sudden I die and discover there's some afterlife or a form of reincarnation, then that I'm be perfectly happy. So,
well, unless you're in hell.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just kidding. No, I hear what you're saying. It's been my experience that as soon as someone commits to something with vehemence, that's when you know not to trust them, because they're just demonstrating that they're not open-minded, and no one really knows what happens, especially when it comes to things like that. No one knows what we're doing here. No one knows where we go when we die. So when someone comes to you telling you they have the answers, that's when you need to turn and run in the opposite direction.
Yeah, I mean, there's empirical questions and there's subjective questions. And if somebody's asking an empirical question, then I have to go to the experts in that particular field and say, well, this is what the evidence seems to show, and this is what the evidence doesn't seem to show. And I'm not a relativist in any sense of the word. So, if it's an empirical question, there are things that admit to right or wrong answers. We just may not know what those answers are yet. And even if we think we do, we want to be subject to willing to change our opinion in light of new and better evidence. But there's also subjective questions that people get hung up on and have strong opinions about that can admit to a variety of answers. And I always have to suss out which one of the two someone's talking about when they ask me a question like that.
Yeah, fair enough. I agree with you. Matt, I'd like to know, in your opinion, I think one of the ways you could help our listeners is because a lot of them are coaches and teachers, and you are, I consider, to be an exceptional coach, cut above the average coach. What do you think makes a great coach, and if there are any like easy to implement tips you could give our listeners on how to become better jiu-jitsu instructors, would you share those with us, please?
Sure. I mean, the first thing is, you know, be sincerely motivated to help your students. So when you're on the mat, the class is about the students. It's not about you. It's not about what you know. It's not about what you can show them. It's not about showing off or proving your skill. It really is about what is the best way to help this group of people that's in front of me right now? This is that the people that are in front of me in the moment are the most important thing I have in my life in that moment. And I'm being paid and I'm here to help them get better. And you have to make that your number one priority. And sometimes that goes astray, not necessarily always for nefarious reasons, but sometimes you have young coaches who are just so, or teachers who are just so, you know, excited to be teaching jiu-jitsu that they just want to show all these different things. And you really have to take a step back and say, is this really the best way to get people this information? So that has to be first, that kind of attitude. And then you have to take a look and say, understand that there are better and worse ways to teach things. And what are the better ways to pass this information on and learn from people who have that information and change as a teacher and evolve as a teacher and focus as much of your time if you're going to be a good coach or a good teacher. That's your job, and you have to focus as much of your time on how you teach and how you coach as you do jiu-jitsu. I think probably the biggest mistake people make in our art, our sport, is they think because someone is good at this art, I mean themselves good, physically good at it, maybe they're a world champion, that they can somehow teach. And those are two very, very different skills. So you have to respect both. You can be a great teacher and not a great competitor. You can be a great competitor and not a good teacher at all. And when it comes time to step on the mat and teach a group of people, you want to make sure you respect the art of teaching as a skill set in and of itself. And if you're going to be good at it, you need to take the time to learn how to be a good coach.
Mm, agreed. Now, when it comes to jiu-jitsu, what is your thought of the direction the modern jiu-jitsu game is moving in? Do you think it's moving too far away from its MMA/UFC fighting applications, like with all the grips and inversions and all the esoteric guards? Or do you feel that the fact that it's sparring against the resisting opponent still gives it the application? I'm struggling for the word, but you get what I'm saying. You get my question.
Yeah, I think that it depends on what you're training for. I can speak to that in specifically or in the broader terms. Let me talk specifically first. If someone's specifically training for self-defense, are they going to get screwed up by spending a long time in a jiu-jitsu school that maybe the majority of the students there are focused on tournament IBJJF, you know, gi style? Not really, because, you know, somebody like Keenan Cornelius gets in a street fight with somebody, unless that person is a very skilled MMA fighter or also a very skilled jiu-jitsu player, he's probably going to be just fine, even though what he does is style jiu-jitsu. It's just jiu-jitsu works so well. You know, it's hard to screw it up. That said, it's real easy to bring it back into functional fighting. And, you take one night a week or a couple days a month and you put the strikes back in a healthy and, you know, a safe way, but you start hitting each other, doing what we call jits with hits, and pretty soon you'll find your jiu-jitsu game starts to simplify, and it starts to move in a direction where you keep your head safe, and you're able to do the most important thing in violent conflicts, which is maintain distance, and you start to focus on distance management just kind of naturally, and jiu-jitsu lends itself to that, so it's kind of hard to screw up. That's at an individual level. On a broad perspective, you know, I am actually pretty optimistic because I think with the Eddie Bravo tournaments and the IBJJF, and now Hickson has stepped in and he has his own rule set he wants to put in. I think as our sport continues to grow around the world, which it is, there'll be competitors, there'll be different rule sets, and people will be able to kind of choose which direction they want to go. And the fighting art of jiu-jitsu, which is the art that I've always been in love with, the art that Hickson teaches, It'll still be here with his students and certainly with our organization. There'll be places for people to go and get it.
Mm, fair enough. Matt, do you mind me asking how old you are at the moment?
I am 48.
48. And how many times do you still get on the mat per week to do your actual training, like sparring and jiu-jitsu?
Probably about, you know, I have a good role probably 2 or 3 days a week at least. Yeah.
Okay. And how have you come to that figure? Is that just what your body can cope with, or have you just set a limit on yourself, or what's your reason for training 2 to 3 times a week?
I should say that's rolling two or three times a week. I'll do other types of training where I'll be in the gym and I'll be teaching. I'll lift weights. I'll do different things. But as far as just rolling, yeah, it's really, you know, how much my body can take and also just time. I have, four children. I have three little kids at home right now, or five children, I should say, with three little kids living at home. Full-time business and a lot of travel. I do a lot of seminars every year still and a lot of other things on my plate. So, even if I wanted to roll 4 or 5 days a week, which would be pretty hard on the body, I'm not sure I'd even have that much time anymore.
Yeah, I understand. I understand where you're coming from. I also have experienced that. I guess the question could be phrased in a different way, and that is, at 48 years old, you're still, from what I can glean from the pictures of you online, you're still in very good shape, and you're still managing to train several times a week and still maintain high-level jiu-jitsu despite having all these busy things in your life. Like, is any advice you could give for the older grappler who wants to still get as much as he can out of the arc? Like, have any things that have helped you, like perhaps yoga or any nutritional tips or anything like that?
I think at this stage, most everybody knows what to do with nutrition. You know, lay off the sugar, don't engage in all the carbs, and make sure you get protein and eating healthy, that kind of thing. Yoga's great. Weights are great. If I stop lifting weights, and I don't do a lot of heavy weight. I'm not doing any kind of bodybuilder routine, but just the basic squats and deadlifts. Those help my body feel better. And there's been years where I took time off of that and years where I never took a day off. And without a doubt, my body has always felt better when I was consistently lifting weights. So I think that's important. But the biggest thing of all is, you know, if I could go back in time to when I was in my early 20s and first learning the art, I would roll then like I roll now, which is a lot more relaxed, a lot less strength, not putting my body in a lot of compromising positions, and just basically training smart. Even if you're a young competitive athlete, you will get better by training that way than you would if you're training hard all the time. And I think, you know, I've made thousands of mistakes as a young coach in my 20s and 30s, but one of the big ones was we trained way too hard. And now at this age, I can definitely feel that in my body in a way that I wouldn't had I been smarter sooner. And our students now that join have the benefit of that hard-earned wisdom where they're going to know that's not necessary to get your jiu-jitsu good. You know, it's not good when your hands are covered in tape. That's not a good sign of your jiu-jitsu. That's a bad sign. That means you're hanging.
Yeah.
The grip's too long. You know, you should be letting go. You should be smoother. So, you know, my goal is to have all the tape on my belt, none of the tape's on my hand.
I love that. That's great. So when you say you said we trained way too hard, and what would that too hard be characterized by? Is that sparring for too many rounds, or is that not taking enough rest days? Specifically, what was that characterized by?
Oh, you know, too much head trauma, too much slamming into the mat, too much, hanging on too long to things rather than just, okay, I've been caught, let's tap early and let's start again. Just putting your body in a position where it's receiving more stress than necessary and risk for injury, you know, allowing yourself, not as opposed to letting someone pass your guard, allowing yourself to get stacked. And then maybe that guy doesn't pass your guard that day and you won that battle, but, you know, years down the road, you've lost the war because your neck's jacked up and you know, mm-hmm. I know a lot of guys that have had that happen. So, those kinds of things, we're just a lot smarter about how we train now. And since the top coaches in my gym, all my black belts that teach in the gym, that way, even the young athletes and the new students that are coming in the gym model themselves after that. Whereas, you know, mm-hmm. walk in my school 20 years ago, it was a whole different ball game. It was much rougher and not like it is now.
For sure. That's great advice. Matt, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us. If people want to find out more about you and your organization, what's the best place they should go to?
Yeah, two places. So if it's about the organization, straightblastgym.com. It has all our schools and all our information. And if they're interested in my writing or podcast, different things I've done, they can look me up at mattthornton.org.
Fantastic. But man, thank you once again. As I said, it's been fantastic to hear your wisdom. And I love the way you approach things in such a methodical manner. It's been great to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, Matt, take care. That was cool. What I like most about Matt is you can just hear in his voice, he is a no bullshit kind of guy. I can just imagine someone trying to sell him something, whether it be a flawed martial arts system or a crappy secondhand car. He just wouldn't have any of it because he's one of those people who's just, he's seen enough and experienced enough and knows enough to just see the world for what it is. And I really enjoyed chatting to him. I model a lot of the way I teach and the way I look at training methods on things that I've indirectly picked up from students of his, including John Kavanagh. So it was fantastic to be able to speak to him. And I think it's a great privilege to have had him on the show. Thanks for listening in, guys. It's been 10 episodes already. I can't believe how quickly that's gone. Remember, if you want to support the show, please visit our sponsors. The first one is the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood store, where you can get 10% off any of our amazing belts, gis, rash guards, t-shirts, patches, and stickers. All you need to do is head on over to store.jiu-jitsu-brotherhood.com, put in the code podcast, and 10% is your discount on everything. The second sponsor is ButcherBox. You guys have been hearing me go on about it for a few weeks now. If you can't afford it, and you care about your body and your health, and also, I guess, your spiritual health, you should be eating free-range meat. And ButcherBox is some of the best free-range meat on the market, delivered straight to your door. If you use the code JJB15, you will get 15% off your first order, and you'll also get free organic bacon. So please head on over to ButcherBox and use the code JJB15. I'll put the links to these on the page with the show as well, so you can head on over to the store or ButcherBox directly. Anyway, guys, thanks again for listening. Should have some cool guests coming up in the next few weeks. Until then, train smart.